All right, so in the last lecture, we talked about the naive Bayes classifier, and there were a couple of bits left over, which I'm hoping to cover today before we jump into nearest neighbors. So just as a refresher, so we talked about the classifier, the various parts of the formula and what they do. We went through two examples, continuous example with Gaussians and a discrete example, and the things that you want to remember there is both the way that it works and the mistakes that it makes, particularly regarding the correlations in the data. So what I want to do now is just briefly go over some generic, just give some generic comments, some generic properties of the naive Bayes classifier that will be useful in comparing it to other things that we do. So the three things that I'll talk about is dealing with missing data. What happens when part of your data is not observable? It turns out that naive Bayes is particularly nice in that regard. Then the computational costs and what you need to do if you need to do learning online, how nice naive Bayes is in that case, and then just a couple of closing notes. So the missing data, this happens if, so remember, we're representing instances as attribute value pairs, and in some cases you'll bump into a situation where some attribute for some data instance is just not there. So it's not the case that the value is zero, it's that you don't know what the value is. This is a general problem that affects all learning methods. When something like that happens, you have to do something. You have to adapt the method in some way or another to cover for that. And it turns out that with naive Bayes, it's particularly simple to do. So what are the examples of this? You know, if you're you know, going back to the loan example, perhaps you know how much the person is asking for, perhaps you know their employment status and things like that, but they may have no credit history, right? So in that case, you have to decide how do you decide that. So no credit history doesn't mean bad credit history necessarily. It doesn't mean good credit history. So you have to do something. And we also talked about it could also happen in non-structured domains. So for example, if you're processing images or some other signal data, you may have garbled observations or corrupted observations where part of the image is occluded and you really don't know what's behind it. It's sort of the data is the pixel values are missing. So when you're dealing with naive Bayes classifier, the place where it hits you is when you need to compute the model probabilities, the class conditional probabilities. So remember, naive Bayes, we have the prior, we have the sort of the normalizer in the denominator, but we also have the these class conditional probabilities, which is just what is the probability of all the values for all the attributes that I observed. And now what you have is you have value for x1, x2, all the way down through xd, except for xj. So how do you compute that if you don't know what xj is? Well, it turns out that with regard to naive Bayes, you can do it very, very simply. The way you deal with missing data is you ignore it. You pretend it doesn't exist. And we'll go over the reason why that works out. But the basic thing that you do is if you need to compute the probability for x1 through xd given some class y, and you don't know the value for xj, what you do is you simply exclude xj from the product of the probabilities. Remember, so this is naive Bayes. We're assuming that attributes are conditionally independent given the class. So what we would normally do is we would multiply together the probabilities for all the attributes. And now we don't have one of the attributes. We don't know what one of these attribute values is. So we just omit it from the product. And that's if you believe that you can do that, then it's actually quite nice because it's simple. You don't have to do anything. You don't need to bother with filling in the values, which is something that you have to do for other classifiers or trying to change the formula itself. So it's quite nice. But why can we do that? Why is that actually the case? Well, it turns out that for naive Bayes, because of the independence assumption, the probabilities factor out in a very nice way. So let's look at a simple example. So suppose I have Very simple example, I have three coin tosses, right? Each coin toss can be either heads or tails. So suppose I want to compute the probability of the event where the first toss was a head, the last toss was a tail, but I don't know what the middle toss was, right? So it's that kind of situation. That's what says x2. That's the value of the second toss. It wasn't observed for some reason. I don't know if it's heads or tails. So one way to compute the way to compute the probability of that event is to break it down into individual events for which we know the probabilities, right? So we could say, well, suppose the second toss was a head. That would be the event HHT, right? Or the second toss could be a tail. That would be the event HTT, right? And the totality, the total event of getting the head on the first toss and the tail on the second toss is the sum of these two events, right? So I get a head on the first toss, and then I don't actually know if I get a head or a tail, and then I get a tail. These are two disjoint events. To compute the probability for an event which is a union of two disjoint events, you can just add together the probabilities, right? So the probability of that event, head, then I don't know, and then tail, that's just the probability of head, head, tail, plus the probability of head, tail, tail. I hope that makes sense. So that's a generic example. It has nothing to do with naive Bayes. It's just probabilities and coin tosses. Now, how does that play out in naive Bayes? So this time I have a sequence x1 through xd. Those are my attributes, class value y. What I want to do is I want to compute the overall probability, the product of the probabilities px1 given y times px2 given y all the way down to pxd given y. Except, as I said, I don't know how to compute this because I don't know what xj is. I don't know if it was a head or a tail, right? Or if xj was one of the words, I don't know the identity of that word or the count, whether it was 0 or 1. So if you play the same trick, if you say, okay, I don't know the value of xj, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to add up the probabilities over all possible values of xj, right? So this is the expression, if I knew xj, I don't know what it is, so I'm going to sum it up over all possible values of that probability. Right, and then what comes to our help is the independence assumption. The independence assumption allows us to take this joint probability and break it down into the product of the individual conditionals, right? So you have this PXJ given Y isolated inside a big product of the probabilities. And then you notice an interesting fact. So I'm summing up over all the values of XJ. This probability of x1 given y doesn't depend on xj, right? It doesn't involve xj. So I can move it outside the summation, okay? Probability of xd given y, that also doesn't involve xj. So it's in effect a constant, and I can move it outside the summation as well. And I can repeat, I can do the same thing, the same exact thing to every single x except for xj. Right. I can move them all outside the summation, and what I get in the end is this product, probability of x1 given y, x2 given y, all the way down to xd given y, except for one element. In one element, you have a sum over possible values of xj, probability of xj given y. And if you think back to the axioms of the probability theory, you know what that is. What is that? It has to be one, right? Why? Because this is the probability of a particular outcome, xj, and this is the sum over all possible outcomes, and the probabilities have to add up to one over all possible outcomes. So that thing over there is just a one. And what does that leave us with? That leaves us with the product over all the attributes in the data which were observed, So anytime you have some attribute which was not observed, it factors out of the equation, right? So that basically, that gives you the reason why you can drop the missing portions of the data from the computation. And of course, you would do this for every class Y, right? Because it, if XJ is missing from an instance, it's going to be missing in every probability calculation for every class. In the numerator, in the denominator, it's always going to be missing. Right? Okay. So another main advantage of the naive Bayes classifier is the computational cost. It's probably the fastest learning method. It's certainly the fastest learning method that we will consider in this class. It has a very nice computational complexity with no hidden constants whatsoever. So if you have n training instances of dimension d and c classes, then O of n dc is going to be the complexity for building up the models. It also has the same complexity for testing. So if you have n testing items and you have built a naive Bayes classifier, that's going to be the same complexity. It's much smaller than almost everything else we're going to consider. Well, not much smaller, but constant-wise, it's certainly smaller than everything else we're going to consider. In terms of space, sometimes it's an issue. So you built a classifier, you want to store it for further use. Naive Bayes is also quite attractive because it has a fairly small footprint. So the footprint is the number of classes times the number of attributes, the dimensionality of the data. It is reasonably compact. We'll see things that are more compact. So decision trees coming up in the following lectures are certainly more compact than naive Bayes, but not any faster. Another major advantage is the naive Bayes classifier can be constructed incrementally. So if you're in a situation where you constantly have new training data coming in, so you know, for example, if you're predicting the stock market using naive Bayes for some reason, then every day you're trying to predict what the closing price is going to be, right? So at the end of each day, you get a new training point. Right, because you know what the closing price was today, and what you want to do is you want to take that new data and sort of adapt your model to that new data. Well, with naive Bayes, it's extremely easy to adapt the data. You don't have to recompute anything in a complicated way. You don't have to retrain. All you have to do is instead of keeping the final probabilities, you keep the raw counts. Right. So, what do I mean by the raw counts? So, if I'm doing if I'm modeling discrete data, then my probabilities are based on counts. How many times did I see that word in ham? How many times did I see that word in spam, right? So you keep the count of the number of times you saw attribute D in class C, and every time you see a new observation X of class C, you just take XD, which is the count, and just add it to the running count, right? And then when the time comes to classify, you on the fly compute the probability of that attribute being one given C. You can do the same thing if you're modeling continuous data. It should really be obvious. If you're doing Gaussians, then all you need to do is you need to keep around sort of the two moments, the sum of all the X's along dimension D for a particular class, and then the sum of the squares. And those give you immediate expressions for the mean and the variance of the Gaussian. So it's basically all that goes to say, if you're working in an environment where you constantly want to adapt your learning algorithm to the new targets, with naive Bayes you can do it very cheaply, very, very, very quickly. So there is an interesting issue regarding naive Bayes classifier and the assumption of independence. So we talked about independence and what it means and how independence actually differs from conditional independence. It's worth mentioning that the necessary condition to derive the naive Bayes classifier is not actually independence and not even conditional independence. The necessary condition is linked dependence. So what that means is you expect roughly the same amount of correlation between attributes in all the classes. Right? So that's different than saying there is no correlation. Conditional independence says once you know the value of the class, there should be no correlation between the attributes. Linked dependence says there can be any amount of the correlation as long as it's the same in all the classes. It's a much weaker assumption, so and it's frequently overlooked. That's actually the assumption that the necessary condition to derive naive Bayes. And there's been several theoretical results showing that naive Bayes in certain restricted domains, such as learning conjunctions, it's actually the optimal method, and it's going to work as well as you could possibly expect. So regarding the structure, so we're talking about, this is just a slide, we're going to do this for just about every algorithm, every learning algorithm that we cover in the class. So we're talking about classification, K-class classification. The model structure in this case is we're going to store K models, one for each one of the classes that we learn, and the models are typically going to be d-dimensional structures. So it's I'm either storing d probabilities for the d different words in the data, and I'm storing this vector for each one of the classes, or I'm going to be storing a vector of the means and a vector of the variances if I'm doing continuous data with Gaussians. The score function in this case, it's conditional likelihood, and there is no search involved because the solution is analytic. So we're doing the maximum likelihood estimate to the class conditional models, and the maximum likelihood in this case, it's a closed form solution. So we just take it just goes to say that you don't actually need to learn anything. You're just computing the average. You're just computing the mean. How many times on average did I see that word in that class? What is the average height? What is the average weight? Right. Those are all closed form expressions. Okay. So I guess let's summarize. So talked about naive Bayes. It's a classifier that has it explicitly handles prior probabilities for the data. It has a component that says what is the prior probability for each class. So it's nice in that regard. You can add prior knowledge to that. We talked about the function of the denominator and how it scales the probabilities and makes outliers comparable to the rest of the data. Whether you want to do that or not, that's another question, but it's nice to have it in there. It handles missing data very nicely. So remember, if you have a missing attribute, you just throw it away, pretend it's not there, and everything works out fine. The major assumption is the conditional independence assumption, which says that all of the covariance, all of the correlations between the attributes are explained by the class label. It's fast and compact. So by the way, why does it matter that it's fast and compact? So usually you just want a very accurate classifier, right? And it doesn't matter how fast it is. Well, it's in some domains, it's important to be fast. You should also always keep in mind that if you have a fast classifier and unlimited amount of training data, a fast classifier is going to be able to learn using more data than a slow classifier. And in some domains, that turns out to play a big role. So if you train a very accurate but slow method using 1% of the data, and then you train a naive Bayes classifier using 100% of the data, a lot of the time, a simpler classifier with more data will beat a more sophisticated classifier. So that's something worth keeping in mind. A couple of things to watch out for if there are strong correlations with the data. So if the class is encoded by the amount of correlation between the attributes, naive Bayes classifier is not going to be able to capture that. So think back to the Gaussian example with sort of positive and negative covariances. If you're doing with discrete data, something that you will immediately bump into is the zero frequency problem. So for about half of the items in your data, you're going to have zero frequencies, and you have to deal with that somehow. It's always going to get repeated. And finally, the fooled by repetitions, that's related to sort of its inability to handle correlation. If you're dealing with discrete data, naive Bayes can be fooled by sort of stuffing it with features that are, with attributes that are normally associated with the class that you want to sort of fake. So, you know, if you're sending a spam email, stick lots of hammy words into it, good technical words, and it'll probably pass the filter. For naive Bayes. All right. So now let's move on to key nearest neighbors. While I'm doing that, any questions on naive Bayes? All right. All right, so now we'll talk about nearest neighbor methods. So I'll briefly outline the method, talk about how we can use it for classification and regression, mention some practical issues that you have to resolve as you're using the method, and then talk a little bit again about computational complexity and how you can make it faster. In this case, there are a couple of book sections that relate to this method. So if you have the book, sections 4.7 and 6.4 are related to this lecture. So let me start with an intuitive example. So I'm throwing up a picture over there, and I'm not telling you what it is, and it doesn't actually matter what it is. So you have some red circles, you have some blue triangles. And then I'm putting a little box there with a question mark, and I'm asking, so is that a red circle or is that a blue triangle? Who thinks it's a red circle? Who thinks it's a blue triangle? Okay, so we don't know if it's a red circle or it's a blue triangle, but the point that I'm driving how did you do that? I mean, did you imagine a Gaussian over the red circles and the blue triangles? did you do maximum likelihood? Right? We didn't do regression, but in regression you try to draw hyperplanes that separate the data, and you probably didn't do any of those things. What you probably did is you probably said, look, this point over there, it looks awfully close to the red circles, and it doesn't look nearly as close to the blue triangles, right? So it's close to this group, and it's not close to that group. So it probably belongs to the red circles group. So that is an intuition that is used to build the nearest neighbor classifier. That's it. That's exactly it. The nearest neighbor classifier, what you try to say is, if you have some data points sitting around in some space and somebody gives you another data point, the way to make a classification there is to find the closest data points and then use the same class for that new point that you're looking at, right? So if you try to make that formal, what we're trying to do is we'll have some sort of data set, we have some data points and some coordinate system, then we're given a new point x, and we're going to look at the distance from x to every point in our training data set, right? Find the nearest point and then take its class. So for example, if my new point is right here, it's closer to red, so I'm going to say it's red. If my point is right here, it's closer to blue triangle, so I'm going to call it a blue triangle. And it's just as simple as that. So that is the definition of the one nearest neighbor classifier. You look at your data set, you find a training point that's as similar to you as you possibly can get, and then you assign its class as a prediction for the new data point. Right? So what does it look like if we try to draw a decision boundary? Well, so something that we have to define is there's a concept called Voronoi tessellation. That's basically if I take each one of the training points and I define a region of space around it such that everything is inside that region is closest to that point is closer to that point than to anything else. That gives me, that sort of fractures a space into these, into this sort of linear bounded polytope-like regions. So what does that mean? That means that this little region is closer to this point than it is to any other point in the data set, right? And any point in this region is closer to this blue triangle than it is to anything else. And points on this boundary are the same distance from this red point to and from this blue point, right? So for the points on the boundary, I don't actually know what's closest to me, right? So that's called a Voronoi tessellation. It's just a partition of space into regions. And then once I throw the labels on there, I can draw a decision boundary. So we talked about that in one of the first lectures. What is a decision boundary? It's something that's supposed to separate one class from another. So in this case, the decision boundary is going to follow the Voronoi tessellation between the two classes. So everything to the left of this red line would be classified as blue, and everything to the right of the red line would be classified as red. Right. So if I had a point over here, it would be classified as red. If I moved over a little bit, it would be classified as blue. It's always going to follow a tessellation for one nearest neighbor. As I said, the boundary, that's when you have a tie. That's when you don't know which point is actually closer, the red point or the blue point right there at the boundary. It's a bit unfortunate that we haven't seen other learning methods. So you'd be able to appreciate the complexity of this a little bit more. So nearest neighbors, it's a very simple method. Right? It took me one slide to sort of tell you what it is, and you don't even need any equations or any algorithms to tell you how it works. It results in surprisingly complex decision boundaries. So compared to what we'll see with naive Bayes, with regression, the decision boundary here, it's non-linear. So and it sort of hugs the classes surprisingly well. Now, there's lots of problems with nearest neighbors, so we'll talk about them. But the sheer power of the method is quite impressive. So with something very, very simple, you're able to learn very complicated decision boundaries. So let's start to look at some of the issues that you get with nearest neighbors. So the first one is the algorithm is sensitive to outliers, but outliers in a bad sense of the word. So not outliers that are far away in the space and not close to any of the points. Those don't actually affect it. But if you have class outliers, so for example, if some of the data is accidentally mislabeled, that throws a serious wrench into the workings of nearest neighbors. So, for example, if I accidentally mislabeled this as red, that has a very dramatic effect on the decision boundary of the class, right? So now everything that's to the left of the second line, everything to the left of it is going to be classified as red again, even though it's a single data point. Right? So a single data point is going to carve out an entire region. So the blue is going to be this short band, and everything else is going to be red. That's a problem in many applications, because it means that a change of a single label, if you change the class label on a single instance, that dramatically changes classification for a lot of the testing points. One way to get around that is to use more than one nearest neighbor. So until now, we've been talking about one and n, which means you got a point, you find one nearest neighbor to it, and you take its class. Right? We can try to make that a little bit more robust. We can say, well, let's find two nearest neighbors. Right? Or let's find three nearest neighbors, and in this case, two of them would be perhaps perhaps blue, and one of them would be red, and the majority would override the single red vote. So that's like taking majority votes. That's like saying, what are the instances that look the most like me, and then taking a majority vote about the class among those instances, right? So now let's try to formalize the k-nearest neighbor methods. So as always, we have our training instances are tuples. The xi is some attribute value representation of the ith instance. Yi is the class label, so that's like ham or spam or the identity of the digit. And then we have a new point x that we want to classify. How does the algorithm work? So the first thing that we have to do is we have to find the nearest neighbors. When I flash a picture in 2D with some points in it, it's obvious to you what the nearest neighbors are. And it's simple to do in 2D, but if you think about doing it in 1,000 dimensions, then finding nearest neighbors is actually pretty complicated. In fact, what you have to do if you don't approximate, if you want to do it exactly, what you have to do is you have to take x, and you have to compute the distance from x to every single training point xi. Right. So you actually have to do it for the entire training data set. So if I have a new point, I have to compare it to everything for which I know the labels. Now, once I've done that, I'm going to select k closest instances, so that these are my k nearest neighbors. I'm going to look at their values, their class labels, y1 through yk, and I'm going to take, as my prediction, I'm going to take the value y, which is the most frequent value, sort of the mode of that set, right? So the way to write mathematically is you would just basically count how many times each y occurs in that set and take the y that has the highest count. All right. So let's look at an example. This is it's a nice application because it actually shows how powerful the method can be. So we're dealing with digit recognition. So we have these handwritten digits, and we want to predict what numeral they correspond to. So in this case, if you take 16 by 16 bitmaps, 8-bit grayscale, the first thing you have to do is you have to define what the distance function is going to be, right? So you'll have a testing point, and then you have to measure the distance from every training point to that testing point. So what is the distance function? In this case, we can take our favorite representation, which is sort of the individual pixel values as attributes. If we define something as simple as the Euclidean distance function over them, that actually turns out to work quite nicely. So what you see here is some comparison of results. So if you take a 7 nearest neighbor classifier with the Euclidean distance on that data set, it's a standard benchmark data set that we'll see again and again in the course. So the nearest neighbor classifier, you get about 4.8% error rate. So that means that you misclassify about 4.8% of the data points. And that's really good because the best that you can get on this data set with a fairly convoluted SVM is about 4.2%. And humans don't do it 100% correctly. So human error rate on this particular data set is about 2.5%. Right? So it's quite impressive that you can get this accurate of a performance with a classifier that's as simple as that. But so let's look a little bit of what it's doing. So what is this distance function doing? I said Euclidean distance over the pixels. How do you do that? It's quite simple actually. You go over the bitmap row by row, and then within each row you look at every pixel. So R refers to the rows, C refers to the columns. ARC is the value of that pixel in image A. BRC is the value of the same pixel in that image. So you just take the difference between the gray levels and square it. And then you move on to the next pixel and the next pixel and the next pixel and so on. Right? So just difference between the two bitmaps squared. So really quite simple. And then what you do is, if you're doing seven nearest neighbors, that means you take your testing example. So this is something for which you want to predict the right digit. Then you find seven nearest things in the training data, and in this case, these are the actual sort of seven nearest neighbors for each one of those examples. So what you see here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of those are zeros of various types, and then the seventh example is a 6. So all of those would be human labeled as 0. This would be labeled as a 6. You take a majority vote, and the outcome is a 0. So it doesn't always work, obviously. So in this case, the first three nearest neighbors are 2s, and then you get 3 8s, and then you get a 7. And it does get confused. It does get confused in some cases. So this is an example. So 9 as a testing image. These are the 7 nearest neighbors, and as you see, the first one is a 9, but then the rest of them are the 7th. So this one would be misclassified. So your classifier would say that this is a 7 because 6 out of 7 neighbors say it's a 7. Okay. All right. So we talked about K-NN for classification. You can also use the same algorithm to do regression. The setup is basically the same. And you run the algorithm in exactly the same manner up until the point where you get the prediction. So you take your data point X, you compute the distance to every Xi, to every training instance in the training set. You pick the k closest instances, and then each one of these training instances has a value Y. And previously, Y was a class label, now Y is a number, right? We're doing regression, so we're predicting some sort of numbers. Maybe we're predicting somebody's age. Maybe we're predicting sort of how much money you're going to make on a certain investment. So the way you generate a nearest neighbor prediction in regression is you take these k values and you just average them up. Right? So if these were the weights of 7 individuals that are closest to you, you would just take the average weight, and that would be your prediction for the new point X. So really straightforward. It's no different from classification, except there you had classes and you were taking a majority vote. Now you have numbers and you're just adding them up. So what does this look like? This is just it's not the best example, but it gets the point across. So suppose that the red line is the true true function that generates the data. We don't get to see it. We sort of see it in the background, but our algorithm can't see it. What our algorithm sees is these green points. So this is our training data, right? So every one of those is a training example. Now, if you're testing in a testing example, you get a value X, which is just a point on that line. So what would be your prediction for that value X? And the prediction depends on what flavor of KNN you're using, specifically on how many neighbors you're considering. So if you take one nearest neighbor, right? So this is my value X. The closest to it is this point right there, right? That's closest as far as X is concerned. So if I'm using one nearest neighbor, I would do the average of one closest point. And the average of one point is just the Y value itself, right? So if I'm doing just one nearest neighbor, I would take the Y value, and this would be my prediction for this value X, right there. If I do two nearest neighbors, then I find the two closest points. So perhaps one of them is this, perhaps another one is this, and then I would take an average of those two. So that would give me that value, that blue circle, as a prediction. So in general, as you play around with nearest neighbors, you'll find that it's going to be quite sensitive to the number of neighbors that you include in your averaging process. So this works both for regression, where the predicted number is going to jump around quite a bit. It also works for classification. So in this case specifically, so if this is my testing point, if I take one nearest neighbor, the prediction is The prediction is red. If I take 2, the prediction is red again. If I take 5 nearest neighbors, the prediction would be blue, right? And then if I take 6 nearest neighbors, then it's probably going to be red again, or it's going to be a tie. And then as you make it larger and larger, the prediction will sort of oscillate. What you want to do in practice is you want to find a balance. You want to find the right value of k. If you pick values that are too large, you're going to have a very smooth classifier, which is basically no different from a prior, right? So imagine doing infinite nearest neighbor. So if you do infinite nearest neighbor, that means you just take your data set and you don't even need to measure distances. You count how many points are in one class, how many points are in another class, and you take the majority, right? So curiously, that's the same thing as if you did just the prior of the naive Bayes, right? So if you do a very large number of nearest neighbors, that's going to be no different than just the prior of naive Bayes. If you have a very small number of k, the results are going to be very sort of highly variable and very sensitive to the training data that you get. So how do you pick the right value of k? There's no formula, there is no magic sort of algorithm for picking the right value of k. The way you do it is by trial and error. So you take your data set, you take your training data, you carve out a small part of it, and you use it sort of as a validation set. We're going to talk about development and validation later, data in the follow-up lectures, but for now, just assume you take your training data, you take a small part of it, you set it aside, and then you build a KNN classifier from the rest of the training data, and then see how well it does on the held out set, right? And you see how well it does for different values of k, right? So you try 1 nearest neighbor, 3 nearest neighbors, 5 nearest neighbors, and so on, and then see which value seems to do the best, and that's the value that you stick with for later. So it's ad hoc, but that's the right way to do it. Another big issue with KNN classifiers is picking the distance metric. So this may not seem like a big deal. It is actually a big deal. Your choice of a distance metric will have a significant impact on the accuracy of the classifier. So we already talked about the Euclidean distance. So that's the simplest one that you can use. You've got attributes I from 1 to d, and what you do is you just take the difference between their numeric values for each, and you just average it up, right? So that gives you the Euclidean distance. It's nice. It's the most straightforward choice. It does have some downsides. So for example, this is Euclidean distance is going to be very sensitive to large variations along a single attribute. So for example, if you have one numerical outlier, or if your data is skewed, has a long-tailed distribution, then doing that sort of thing, it can lead to very, 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 very unstable estimates of the distance. There's other things you can do. A generalization of the Euclidean distance is the p norm. So the difference there is instead of squaring the distance and then taking the square root as you do in the normal Euclidean distance, is you raise the distance to the power p and then you take the pth root, and then p can be any number bigger than 0, right? So and by varying the p, you can get various sensitivities so if p is equal to 2, obviously you get the Euclidean distance. If you take an infinite p, what do you get? I think you get an or, don't you? The p norm with an infinite p. Yeah. So you get a max or an or of the attributes, and if you take a very small value of p, you can get product like behavior from your distance function. Okay. In some domains, you have specific definitions of distance that make sense. So, for example, if your observations are distributions, so if if A and I, if AI and BI are probabilities over some sample space, then the right way to measure distances between them is to use an entropy-based measure. So, for example, you could use something like relative entropy as a distance metric. And if you have probabilities, that's really the right choice. In other domains, it often pays to design specific distance functions for your domain. So, for example, if you're working with text, you would not want to use any one of these things. For text, you have very specific distance functions that have been optimized to measure distances between two pieces of text correctly, and that's what you would want to use. All right, so a couple of practical things that you need to resolve. So as you're doing nearest neighbors, sometimes you will have ties. So imagine you've got, you picked 9 nearest neighbors as the optimal. You have 3 classes, and then you have 3 examples vote for one class, 3 vote for another class, and then 3 vote for the next class. So how do you deal with that? One way to deal with that is sort of draw a random number and sort of flip a coin and see and just decide randomly between the 3 classes, because really you have an equal number of votes for each class. So if you break randomly, that's just as good as anything else. You could pick the class with the greater prior probability. So that's like saying, if I have a tie in the k nearest neighbors, then I expand to an infinite nearest neighbor case, and then just take the class which is a priori more likely. Another way to break ties is to sort of, if you have a tie, you drop back to 1 nearest neighbor, right? So you look at the point which was actually closest to your testing example and use its class. So if you have missing values, it's not nearly as nice with naive Bayes. So this is one example where you have to fill in the missing values. So if you don't know the value of some attribute, that's bad, because you still have to compute the distance function between that instance and everything else in your data. And that means that you have to provide some sort of a value in there to make things comparable. How do you do it? Well, there's no guidance. There is only tricks. The basic criterion, what you're trying to achieve when you're filling in the value, is you want to try to perturb all the distances as little as possible by when you're filling in the value. So so a good choice is, when you're filling in the value, try to put in something that is